Good afternoon. Tuesday, 5 o'clock, St. Andrew's Day, 30th of November, 2021. Yes, my Scots accent doesn't come out that often. Welcome to this week's What Comes Next Live. This is the 71st one of these that we've done, starting back in June 2020, which seems a lifetime ago in COVID time. Of those guests, my very first guest was Mark Beaumont, who was my first repeat guest. And my second guest was my esteemed friend, Miss Alex Barker, who has, when we chatted a few weeks ago, said, oh, we should do this again. I'm sure there's brand new What Comes Next. And she says, well, what should we talk about? And I said, well, it's always whatever the guest wants to talk about. So, hi, Alex. Welcome back on.
Hello. It's a pleasure. At the beginning of... Well, when we did this episode last time, I felt a little bit nervous because I don't think I'd done that many, definitely not live streamed events, because it was still quite near the beginning of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And obviously I feel very differently a year on. And also, yeah, I have since launched a podcast. So the regularity of interviewing and being interviewed has increased a lot. So, yeah, it's a pleasure. And also, I didn't feel like we didn't get to talk about a lot of the things that we often talk about that are really enjoyable to me. So,
well, it's, yeah. I mean, it's totally your show and what you want to talk about. And perhaps for people listening to this podcast, apart from anything else, tell them what your podcast is, but also maybe, you know, what resonates for you that's gone on between the beginning of July in the last, what is that, 17 months?
Yes, and I'm going to weave that into a question to you seamlessly. seamlessly. So my podcast is called Be More Pirate, we interview people who challenge the status quo in some way, mm-hmm. and are rewriting the rules in their sphere. So it has been a hugely eclectic range of people. Mm-hmm. One of our first guests was George the Poet, which I was extremely pleased about. I have bit of a history of working with him a long time ago, and he has almost disrupted the podcasting genre. So he's a real artist, but he's also studying economics. So he's this interesting fusion of policy change and the arts, and phenomenal. There was a woman who had set up a community for people who want to be either sober or drink less, which I think is an interesting rebellion to put under the banner of piracy. So hugely interesting people. Mm-hmm. But I suppose the overarching characteristic was this fierceness around doing things differently, doing things in a different way. And the power and the passion of their drive to do it was what comes across. And the goal of the podcast was to help people feel that they could also step into that kind of agency and leadership but really, in terms of what's changed over the last sort of July, from July to now, it's so interesting. And it really relates to how a role that I see you play often, mm-hmm. because we're in this period where the pandemic isn't over. It definitely isn't over. We seem to be hitting another dip. Yeah. And yet we are trying to grapple with some semblance of a new normal, the word that has I think just that everyone has to say but doesn't like saying. So we're in between paradigms in a way, and I think there's a lot, there's a lot said about what the new workspace will be. That feels like it's dominating people's headspace at the moment, particularly if we're talking about workplace culture. What will it be in terms of flexibility, digital versus non-digital? What's really good for us as humans? What's really going to serve us? How do we cope with this level of uncertainty, this ongoing uncertainty? And I think when we first met, Tom, we met at a conference, and we were talking about lots of global challenges pre-pandemic. And towards the end, there was a call out to put forward an idea or something, a potential solution, I think, or something that you wanted to discuss. Mm-hmm. And draw people into a discussion. And you stood up and said, I want to talk about the tension between profit and purpose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I understand it correctly. And I was really interested in that because that was exactly what I was grappling with working with business leaders. And what was striking wasn't the topic per se. There were elements of the topic that were interesting. I was really curious to know what you'd experienced, but it was your leadership style. It was the way that you had managed to take control of the group in a way, but in a way that was not dominant. Mm-hmm. And that is such a skill. I don't know if you're aware that you're doing it, and we've talked about it in respect to it being a blend of masculine and feminine energies, or however you want to articulate that, but the balance between a kind of a caring, empathetic, inclusive approach versus leading people so that they can reach a conclusion and have a discussion that is sort of veering towards action. And that's something within my work I find so valuable. So is that how you see it? Have you deliberately tried to work in that way?
Yes, and I couldn't articulate it as well as you just did. I'm just reflecting. I'm wearing my, I'm very proud of this garment. It's my Harris Tweed jacket, with the Orb mark on this side, but bought in Brooks Brothers in Manhattan. And, my heritage is from that island. I was up at a conference in central London today and with a client, a startup that's growing really fast. And several of them have flown in from the States, and just in this really exciting period. And I know exactly what they need to do next. But they're four founders, and I've already been working with them on their purpose because I see that as a foundational business asset. Mm-hmm. Now it's like, okay, now they've got a tiger by the tail and they've got to hold on to the rocket ship, if I blend my metaphors. Mm-hmm. So just listening to them over lunch, which is the meeting we had, mm-hmm. and looking just to understand where they're coming from, and just know, look, we don't know all the answers, but first thing we need to do is work out what each of you want, and then we take it from there. And here's a few guideposts that are going to happen. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the short answer is yes.
Yeah, because I think what I was trying to say is you're bridging something. You act as a bridge, and that is so needed in moments like this, where there is so much uncertainty and there's a sense of one foot in the old way and a foot in the new way. Hmm. And people aren't quite ready to necessarily move completely. They need somebody who can speak to the old and the new at the same time. Hmm. And, you know, I've very crudely called that masculine and feminine, but I think there is a lot of business leadership has been rooted in a more male way of doing things, dare I say it, versus.
Yeah, I mean, I frame it as open leadership, and I look at that as being, you know, just a different style of leading, about being brave, hungry, open, and humble. Mm-hmm. Those are the four attributes that I see, you know. I've got an article about that in the footer of my site. The old way of leading, this is the way we've always done it, is very much rooted in a masculine drive type energy. And typically most leaders are historically men. Yeah. But again, masculine, feminine is not male, female. But it's about command and control at the extreme. It's about hierarchies. It's about the omnipotent CEO who has all the answers.
Yeah.
And the practical, the bridge from one of the bridges from the old to the new is that nobody can possibly have all the answers anymore. There's too much data and information in the world, and there's too much speed of change in the world for anybody with any level of expertise, skill, brilliance, experience of, you know, any background, any gender, any, you know, there's nobody can have the answers. So having the humility to know that you've got the answers, and then, but trust that your organization does or can have the answers, is this really big paradigm shift. Mm. And part of the bridge is to go, look, if you can't have the answers, what way forward is there?
Mm. Yeah. How do you create a sense of confidence and reassurance whilst also,
well,
you know, yeah, not having answers.
So this, you know, to be clear on answering the question more generally, it's not how do I do it, but it's actually how would I recommend people look at it, is my one, I kind of distill things into sort of one sentence, like short aphorism sometimes. And one of them is that the one line job description of a CEO is keeper of the vision. And so the CEO, the less a CEO does, the more valuable they are to the company. They should be, it's their state of being, it's their listening, it's their understanding, and they have to have clarity of vision, which, and they have to be paying attention to, it, are the actions and decisions in the company moving us towards that vision? Mm-hmm. But it's really two thoughts. First of all, they don't need to know how to get there. They just need to be clear that that's where they're going to go.
Mm.
I don't know how we're going to get there, but I'm confident we will.
Mm. Mm.
So my friend Chip Conley, a past guest on the show, long ago referred to it as being a vulnerable visionary.
Mm-hmm.
So to, with confidence is the important piece. The CEO has to have confidence in the vision and they have to hold the course and, but also steer the ship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like you using these metaphors. Yeah.
Well, and the other one for me is, I've got a client who's, a past client, Morgan DaCosta, who was actually on the show a while ago from Cayman. The only time I've done a show in the same room as somebody, when I was in Cayman a few months ago. And I gave this one to Morgan and I drew it for him and he loved it so much. He's got it up by his desk to remind him when he gets excited and races ahead with ideas in his business as the CEO. I said, never be more than one hilltop ahead.
Mm.
And if you imagine, and I'm for the listening audience, I'm drawing on the screen with my hand. Imagine you draw several hilltops, right? And imagine the old story from Cervantes of Don Quixote. Right, the guy who thought he had an army of 5,000 following him, and he was on horseback and, you know, a knight in armor. Actually, of course, he was on a donkey with his trusty servant with him. Right. But if you are if you're the leader and you're going out ahead to, in that direction of vision, right? You have to if you go to the top of the next hill, your army can still see you and follow you.
Yeah.
If you go too far ahead, they've lost sight of you.
Yeah.
So that's a part of, why I mentioned that is it's part of the keeper of the vision piece. So you don't have to have the answers, but you have to have confidence in the people, and note that I'm framing this as if there is one person leading. And it's more complex than that.
Mm.
But typically if there is one person at the head of an organization, they have to have confidence in the vision, in themselves and in their people, to achieve it. That's it. I'm riffing on this. There's the Little Prince, right? Antoine Saint-Exupéry, who wrote this. Well, not in the book, but it's a fantastic book. I love it in both French and English. And but he also said, you know, what's, I can't remember the exact phrase, and it also translates differently than in true translation. But it's, you know, if you want people to sail to distant oceans, you don't teach them how to build a ship. You teach them how to yearn for the endless sea.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Yes, I almost use that as a quote in my book, but I felt in the end it was probably a bit too overused. But it's a beautiful quote. And I also really like what you said about the hilltops, because it reminded me of something else I heard recently, which was, if you're going to teach something, it's better to be taught by someone who is one step ahead of you than 10 steps.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Gives me confidence in some of the things I'm teaching actually, which, yeah. Something else I was interested in, something you mentioned the other day actually, was in the spaces where you begin to work with, business leaders, entrepreneurs, and it being in this, because you've talked a lot about liminality over the last year, if we're going to talk about what's next and what's come up, mm-hmm. And when the moment when people are in a liminal space, mm-hmm. Or a transition period, again, it speaks to your bridge building capacities. Why is that space so interesting to you? It's almost a point, I suppose it's the point when they don't have that level of certainty, when there is when they've hit one particular ceiling and there's a kind of almost like a moment before the next period. Or how would you describe it?
Again, you've got a real ability with language. And so that's a great description. It's a great question. So I'm just pausing on it. What makes that space between particularly interesting? It does, to some extent, it comes down to what's top of mind for me is your colleague Sam has just run a series called The Uncertainty Experts, and they just sent through the scores from the self-assessments pre and post for the quite large number of people, I think, who did it.
Did you improve or did she, what happened?
I did. And at the risk of being immodest, from a pretty high base. I mean, I like uncertainty. It's not an entrepreneurial part of me. What attracts me to it is its latent potential. It's latent potential, and it's like the anonymous client I was talking to at lunchtime. It's really, they're absolutely brilliant at what they do, and there's huge potential there.
Yeah.
But they don't know how to build the business and the value of the business and the potential and the scale of the business.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I couldn't do what they do. But what I can do is that. So they can, if I bring that to them, then they can go off and do what they're brilliant at, and they can realize that potential. And I like that space of uncertainty, but I also like the fact that there's no right or wrong in this, but some people are fearful of uncertainty and in a fog about uncertainty. Other people can see through it.
Yeah.
And, just have the hunger to get through it and the drive. Mm. I love being part of that, and I love helping make that potential possible. So the word bravery always comes up for me.
Mm. Yeah, bravery and potential. That's why you like it.
Pretty much, yeah.
And I think, yeah, you're right. In uncertainty, well, I'm careful of the word uncertainty because it could mean, you know, there's issues with language always that
absolutely.
It can mean a spectrum of things. And, I mean, I love the reframe of uncertainty that Sam has done and that you've just done with, that it can represent something quite different to just fear, which is what a lot of us do tend to recourse to when we think of uncertainty. I was thinking about this in respect of the concept of risk as well. Because of course, I mean, people do talk about risk in a positive light, but I think for the majority of people, it represents something that's quite scary or daunting to do. And I think the biggest lesson in some ways I've learned, not just this year in the pandemic, but over the last 3 or so years, is really understanding that nobody else outside of me can tell me what is a risk, because overcoming or being able to work with risk is so dependent on my individual faculties, my personal levels of resilience, my, as you just described, your delight in the roller coaster, the adventure, the uncertainty. And personally, I have quite a high tolerance for it too, I've realized, but I almost wouldn't have known that had I not been able to experience it. But everybody from when I was very young was told you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that because it's risky. But it is such a subjective thing. And the faculties that I need to understand much more clearly than an external thing to me are, what's my energy levels like today? Where's my momentum coming from? Where's my drive coming from? Where is, how anxious do I feel about certain things? So that's all for me to determine, and that changes as well. So I think that's something, I think that, that very much speaks to the sort of uncertainty thing. And it feels like how you also coach people, to me, at least from what I've learned.
I've got a thought on that. And before that, what we never framed up is you called me up yesterday and said, hey, I know what I want to talk about. I want to turn the tables and interview you.
Yes.
So for regular listeners, it's like, why isn't he asking Alex any questions?
I did say,
20 minutes in, you know. One of the things I find really useful is sometimes if you point at people and say, this is who you are, this is what you're doing, this is etc. And you're telling them, consulting with them as an expert, if you will, mm-hmm. it won't land very well. And sometimes it's useful to do that and be direct and create not a difficult conversation. You know, people like, oh, there's the conflict is what Americans are called it. Britons call them difficult conversations. I don't believe in difficult conversations. I think if your intention is good, there's no difficult conversation. But it's sometimes useful to get people to frame it themselves. So there's various, what I call indicator tools, not tests and assessments that you are this, but conversation pieces. And one of the ones I love is one I use called a risk indicator. Because it's an online indicator and I just have the clients do it.
Yeah.
And it talks about their, and the results it gave, among other things, it talks about their natural risk and their environmental risk.
Mm.
So yeah. What's your, generally speaking throughout life, what's your risk profile? What's your tolerance to risk?
Yeah.
And your environmental risk may be different. It's really fascinating to me that one of the things around business, this is a bridge from the, if you will, the old language of business to the new, is business and risk.
Mm.
And with things like the global financial crisis a dozen years ago, every board of directors now has a risk committee and they have a chief risk officer. Right. But as another past guest, Chris van der Kyle, talked about, this is the role of the people responsible for risk in the business is to enable people in the business to take risks, mm. not to stop them.
Yeah.
But within that, the risk indicator, imagine you have a board of directors and one has a risk profile of where the lower the tolerance, the lower the number, has a risk tolerance of 2. Another has a risk tolerance of 4. 2 have a risk tolerance of 6 and 1 has a risk tolerance of 9. Just with that, Alex, and if there was a decision to be made about investment, how is that conversation going to go?
Mm.
Well, what would you think?
I would think that it would go air towards the side of not taking the risk.
And what's the person with a risk tolerance of 9 going to feel like in that conversation?
Bored.
Yeah, frustrated.
Disappointed. Angry, disappointed. Yeah.
Upset at the 2 and 3 going, why do they keep asking all these damn questions? Why won't they make any decision? Right? And so that's really, can be, I've done this with a very large company and they went, whoa, you know, we're having real conflict at the board. I said, and tell me about some of the difficult conversations. And I said, okay, all of you do the risk profile. And let's, then now let's sit down. So the first piece was understanding where everybody was coming from.
Mm, yes.
The second piece, which no business generally does, is to go, okay, for your business, what risk profile from 1 to 10 would you choose as a business?
Mm.
So this was actually, the numbers are slightly different, but it's pretty much that live case study. And I asked them, they said, well, actually, we're actually a dynamic business that needs to grow fast. So we're actually they agreed on 6.5 out of 10. So the two who are around that number anyway, that's fine. Said to the person who was a huge risk taker, I said, can you be the person who provokes the business to take more risk and then accept when they don't?
Mm.
Right? And they said, yeah. And for the people who are 2 and 3, can you be the people, can you accept the risk profile of 6+? And can you be the people who do the quality control, that you make sure you've done the due diligence, et cetera? And they went, yeah. Okay, now go to your shareholders and go to your financiers, your banks and your investors, and explain to them very simply, what does 6.5 mean to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, that's, and imagine in those situations that one of those people might have been doing fine financially, but they had a parent go into care and had to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
They just got divorced 6 months later. And lost half their assets
mm.
and a very nasty settlement. And all of a sudden, everything they thought to be certain in life, that their parents would be there forever, you know, because they hadn't thought about it, they're quite young,
mm-hmm.
and that they'd be married forever. Those things are identity threats and they change people's environmental risk profile.
They do. And conversely, so, those moments can make you feel more tolerant to risk as well, though, but I think it totally depends.
Yeah. And so I use that because that's some of that. That's a human conversation. Because risk is about how, it, as you just said, it's subjective. It's about how you feel. It's subjective and it's analytical.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So it's both.
Interesting. I like that. I really like that and that assessment tool. Before we go, before we wrap up, I do want to ask you the big question of what is next, Tom? What is next? What comes next? You've asked 70 odd people. What's going on?
What comes next?
Well, yeah. What have you actually begun to, have you begun to see some patterns in what people have been talking about and reflecting on?
Oh, that's a really good question. That's a really good question. I've been writing for over 4 years now. Pretty much every day. Every day except for two breaks in 4 years for holidays. So over 1,450 posts. Absolutely seen patterns in those. I write about the same things over and over again from different themes. So that's been interesting because that informs a lot of my work. And it's I do a lot of reading and research and talking to people, which creates the posts and there's that. But yeah, I don't know. What would the... I think the pattern's more in the guests.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a meta pattern.
Okay.
A bit like you talked about your podcast. There's a consistency in the guests.
Mm-hmm.
I think the consistency is they're open.
Okay.
And I think that's a great question. I think they are brave, hungry, open and humble. I think they're all open leaders in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
That's the consistent theme. And I'd never thought about that. So that's second part of your question. The first part of your question, which is the big one, it's really it's preliminary.
Yeah.
I'm in a place where I started consciously making some fairly radical changes in my life about 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago, and they were quite significant in personal and business, and that's now been in a really, and you're a friend of mine, that's been in a really settled place now for at least a couple of years. And I have a very high energy level. And I need
to. I know.
I'm really motivated by people and ideas. So I'm quite good about being predictive. Like it's interesting you're talking about the main conversation lots of people are having is about return to work. I was having those conversations 15 months ago. I've moved past that onto the next conversation. So sometimes I'm too early on things. So for me, being predictive, it's so I've started to look at this. So first of all, I'm looking to take on a couple more clients. I'm looking to take on a couple more mentees. But for me, it's about, I'm going to take the longest. I used to build businesses and be part of businesses. I used to be part of teams. But for a number of years, I have this sweet spot that I love of working with leaders and being alongside them as clients. So what comes next is being part of businesses as chairman, a board member, but we're not talking listed companies. I am not one of fine for people choose that, but I'm not a non-exec director because I won't do that because there's too many 50 plus year old white males do that. So. But what I will do is if I can support a business as a board advisor, over a multi-year period to take them to their vision and help them realize their potential, then I'll do that. And for me, the best way of doing that is predominantly just having an equity stake in the business and having the same alignment as the founders and leading people in the business.
Mm-hmm.
So in investment speak, old speak, that's portfolio management. But actually, it's not that. I love being part of something for a longer period of time. So that's what's next, is to keep doing what I'm doing and add a few investment stakes into some businesses and be part of the team. I think so. What comes next is being part of the team and that could be, you got me going. So it could be investing in business, shares in a business doing something, or it could actually be, and I've sniffed around this for a few years, but nothing's really fit, but it could actually be joining a team of people doing similar things to me to scale what I do.
Hmm.
So I'm just leaving myself open to that. doesn't feel liminal, because liminal is this, Chip calls it gooey, is this space in between. But it's more just the, what's the next string to the bow? What's the next step? Because actually what comes next is broadly more of the same.
Yeah, but I think that's right. I think that when you're going to make a move somewhere, it kind of often does feel like the next logical step. You know, it's like, oh, okay, I see now. This is the next kind of, I'm being led in this direction. I kind of feel the draw there. Where I think it's, it can get tricky is when you're trying to make a leap into something that is quite, there's quite a lot of resistance to, within you towards, or you think, oh, I'd like to do that, but I have no idea, you know, what that is or what that looks like. And I think that's when you're successful, is when you sort of make the next logical move, based not on like what maybe looks logical from the outside, but what feels logical from the inside.
Well, you just said the key word, because when you said the next logical move twice, language wise, logical lands to me as being rational and in the head. And then it's.
That's not what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's when it, tend to, in my experience, the way I believe people make decisions is they think about it first. Then they feel, when they're in a place where they're not liminal and gooey, then they can start thinking about it with clarity, and it feels right. It feels logical. They think about it first, then they feel it. And then they know it. Now, for me, the process is slightly different in this particular time frame for me. This feels very selfish talking about myself and not asking you any questions, because I could go right at you with that question when you started saying that. But once I feel it, I'm just actually opening myself up to it. Now that sounds quite weird, but I'm just going, okay, I'm ready for things to come my way. And literally in the last, so if you ask me where does the next project or piece of work or client come from, I never know. But I do know that about a few weeks ago, I opened myself up to the idea, and like out of thin air, I have more approaches to do work in the last 3 weeks than I have for the last 6 months. But for the last 6 months, I was going, I'm fine as I am. I don't actually want any more work.
But I really find that. I find when I know the kind of work that I want to do and I'm open to it, it comes in a weird way, as opposed to when I'm sort of in a place where I'm like not quite sure if the way that I'm working is the right way. I had this last weekend. I did a weekend away with a group of women. It was not a work thing. We were there sort of more socially than anything, but we decided to take a day and workshop some of our our challenges. They're very pirate. We talked about challenging the status quo, but we also talked about how they were going to become more confident in telling the stories of what they were doing, so that they could actually get that message out to the people and build more allies. And I thought, came away from it, I thought, God, that was lovely. We're in a, you know, it was a retreat setting, so we had dinners and things. I thought, I'd love to do more like that. And then within 2 days, I had an invite to another one with a group of women, and run a workshop and everything. And I thought, that's it. That's where I want to go.
Well, perhaps we just look at the time. We should probably close off in a bit, but you and I could talk for hours as always.
Yeah.
I learned a word a few years ago, and I wrote a blog about it. And the word is Zemblanity, which is the opposite of serendipity.
Oh,
and another of my oft-repeated aphorisms is, I don't believe in coincidence. I believe in creating space for serendipity. And there's something in that, the energy stuff that you and I just talked about, which is that we all know people who all kinds of bad things happen to them all the time.
Yeah.
Right. But they're all, sometimes that's just might be, I air quotes for the listeners, that could be luck. Right. But a lot of times they could just create that for themselves. Right. And I mean, it sounds very privileged to be talking this way, because a lot of people are in very tough circumstances. But even within that, you know, how you relate to your circumstances is up to you. And how you relate to potential for opportunity is up to you. And, you know, sometimes I was talking to somebody a while ago, and they said, oh, this happened to me, this happened to me, this happened to me. I said, you must find the same. And I went, honestly, I don't have that experience. And, you know, the language I can use, which doesn't minimize that person's experience, say, that's simply not my experience. And if I say to somebody who isn't on the other side of that, they're not having the opposite experience, I'll typically say, those people don't come into my orbit.
Yeah.
So I tend to have, I think there's something about that. That's a different conversation that sits on the other side of the bridge from the old to the new.
Yes. Yeah, it is definitely. I know exactly what you mean. And, I talk a lot about the problems that exist in the world and the systems and how they don't function properly as part of my work. And sometimes I'm very conscious that it can be very negative, or appear negative. But the thing that really is my experience, and I know that this is not other people's experience, that the thing that is my experience that keeps me going is that I am consistently meeting and interacting with incredible people, just people who are just make you believe in life and all and human potential. And that is just consistently my experience. And so when people say, oh, I don't trust anyone, people are kind of bad, I'm like, what? Who do you meet? I don't know. I feel like I feel very lucky in that respect. So in contrast to what I can see going on at a systemic level beneath that. Yeah. And that's not everyone's experience, of course. But we could start that conversation another day.
Probably wrap up.
Yeah. I'm going to yoga now, so. I'm handing the baton back to you. Thank you, Tom. That was an excellent interview. I'm grateful to have you on my show.
Which is called Be More Pirate, but currently this week guesting as the guest host of What Comes Next Live.
We should say that Be More You is a tagline you've used many, for how long? I don't know, but Be More You is also a chapter at the end of Be More Pirate. So there's
crossover. That predates you and I meeting, so it's just serendipitous. But Be More You is a phrase I learned in 2012 from my late mentor, Ed Purcell. So. And never be less you, be more you. Great way to end. And so many thanks. That's been different and lots of fun. Thanks a lot, Alex.
Thank you.
And see you soon.
See you soon.